Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. Based at the University of Manchester, we're Europe's largest research and teaching institute addressing poverty and inequality. Each episode, we'll bring you the latest thinking, insights, and debates in development studies.
Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. I'm Tom Gillespie, lecturer in international development at the University of Manchester. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Raquel Rolnick. Raquel is an architect and urban planner and a professor at the University of Sao Paulo. She's worked in both local and national government in Brazil. And between 2008 and 2014, she was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing. Raquel is the author of several books, including her latest title, Urban Warfare, Housing Under the Empire of Finance, which we will be discussing today. We're also joined by Isaac Rose, who is a coordinator of Greater Manchester Housing Action, which, as the name suggests, is a housing campaign based in the city of Manchester. So, Raquel, I just wanted to begin by asking you about urban warfare, your new book, which was informed by your experience as Special Rapporteur for Adequate Housing for the United Nations. Could you just tell us a bit about how you came to this role for the UN and what this role involved?
Sure. First of all, I'm very pleased to be here and have this conversation. The UN Human Rights Council, which is the body of UN made of the diplomatic representation of the countries that deals with human rights specifically, have created special mechanisms to monitor the implementation of the resolutions and bylaws defined by the Council. But also, it was very important for the Human Rights Council as being a body of the country's representation, the official representation, to have some sort of external view of a type of ombudsmen and women in order to receive complaints on violations of human rights and then present an independent report to the Council and be able to do that. So the Council have created several mechanisms, including special rapporteurs, but also working groups in different rights. And they create special rapporteurs for certain periods of time. So this is the case, the special rapporteur on the right to adequate housing or extreme poverty, on health, and many other rights. And I became the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Housing following the mandate of Milon Kutari from India, who got the mandate from 2010 up to 2014, the first mandate on housing. And to tell you the truth, I was not familiar at all with the system. As an urban planner, as a housing policy maker, but also throughout all my life as a professor and academic researcher on urban and housing issues, I did not come from the human rights or the legal background. So I was not very familiar with those mechanisms, which are pretty much circulate within the legal community and human rights community. But when the candidacies to this position were open, I was pushed towards to present my candidacy, my name, and I was pushed by international organizations that deal with housing rights, like the Habitat International Coalition, the International Alliance of Inhabitants, because they consider that having a background in policy making, in housing, but also having a very deep relationship with urban social movements and housing social movements in Brazil and Latin America, I was able to represent the quest of the social movement around housing. So Brazilian government had support my candidacy in the council together with several organizations. So that's how I came to be rapporteur without knowing what was the whole role. And then, surprise, is one rapporteur, a voluntary position, non-paid, one rapporteur for the world, without money, without a team, with just one assistant based in Geneva, and I was based in São Paulo. So it was a very tough mandate, I can tell you.
And your role as rapporteur enabled you to develop a global perspective on the housing crisis, both in the global north and the global south. So you visited many cities around the world, and in your book you argue that the global housing crisis needs to be understood in relation to the increasing financialization of housing. Could you tell us how you define housing financialization? What does this mean?
Yeah, no, first of all, it's important to understand that all the rapporteurs, they have the means and the resources to do two missions, country missions a year, which means to visit a certain country and to assess the housing conditions at a certain country and then present back a report. And also they have the obligation of not only presenting those two country reports a year, but also two thematic reports a year to the Human Rights Council. So why I introduced that? Because my mandate started in 2008, and I got the chance, and most of the world got the bad chance, of the coincidence of my mandate with the financial crisis, which was also a mortgage crisis and a housing crisis. So all of a sudden, when I started my mandate, housing, that used to be in the council a matter of non-developed country, of the global south with their slums and informal settlements and precarious conditions, became a topic of European and North American countries. So we are talking about, and the complaints that were arriving towards the special rapporteur was on housing violations in the global north, which means rise of homelessness, people losing their homes, protests and demonstrations, raising in foreclosures, thousands of empty homes, protests around housing, housing crisis in US, in Spain, in other countries that were not in the previous year, in the forefront of housing issues or violations on the right to housing. So I started to try to understand what happened with that. Doing country visit, one of my first country visit was to the US in 2009, and then that followed many, many others. So I was following the results of the financial crisis as a housing crisis in different places, and that came for me a kind of a research hypothesis. And the research hypothesis was that we were witnessing a global process, of change, and very important changes in the housing field. And I could denominate this global process as the financialization of housing, which is basically the change in the material but also symbolic, cultural and political meaning of housing, from being a social policy, a human right, a part of the welfare, or something that has to do with building communities and communal organization, towards housing as a commodity, but housing as a financial asset. And how much the field of housing became the playground for financial capital, the surplus of capital, which circulates madly in the world and park in the housing sector. With, of course, we are talking about the global process, like any other global process. It's one single process, but completely different in each country, because, of course, dependent on the political economy of housing and land in each country.
As a scholar and a practitioner from a global south country, Brazil, researching housing, not just in the global south, but also in the global north, how do you think this informed your analysis of the global financialization of housing?
There are two things that are important to set in relation to that. First of all, my position as a urban and housing researcher in the academic world, and not only my position, but the position of most of Global South scholars, has been to do country or city case studies, to be part of global theories which are presented and proposed by Global Northern scholars and academic centers. So I think that there is what happened with my mandate and myself, it was a sort of a dislocation. And why this dislocation? Because of two things. In the housing and urban policy, if you take the action and the research, and the research and also the action and policy proposal in the Global South, since I started to work as a practitioner and as a researcher, was, okay, let us be like Europe or like the US when we finally get developed. So the idea was having to mirror the experience of the North, and the prevalent theory, the hegemonic thought is, oh, too bad, we are not like them, and we have to achieve this level of development in order to be like them. So all of the sudden, they are breaching human rights. So their model of housing and urban is not a model anymore, because it failed, and this is, I think, my main discovery point of research, is that financialization of housing, which has clearly promised that through the market, everybody will have access to housing and adequate housing, and the mobilization of finance will be the device for the private market to be able to do that. And the result was the contrary. Instead of really providing adequate housing for all, what we have witnessing is a regression in housing rights in countries that used to be much more universal, like in terms of access to affordable housing, of adequate housing, like the UK or like the US. Never universal, of course, but I mean, clearly a regression on that. So I think it's to point out that the problem is in a theory that, again, was invented in the North, which is neoliberal housing policies and financialization, and it was tested as laboratories in the South as well, and the case of Chile is a great case to show that. You can see the failure of the model. So we finally, from the Global South, are free from imitating and mirroring and saying, okay, enough is enough. We don't want to do that anymore. Unfortunately, this is not what's happening, because as a global process, we have seen this change of housing from being a social policy into a financialized policy throughout the world, even in places where social policies were not in place in the first time, but they were a kind of hope or illusion to have even in those places.
Could you tell us a bit more about this model that emerged in countries like the US and the UK in the 1970s and then gradually was disseminated globally? So how did these policies travel from one part of the world to another? Did they always take the same form in different places? And did you find that the impacts of these policies were uniform or were they diverse?
The policies are completely different in each country they travel. So it's the same mantras, it's the same ideas, and international cooperation agencies had a very important role in disseminating them. Like famous World Bank influential book, Housing Enabling Markets to Work, but also the urban side of it, Unlock Land Values. So those are very powerful policy-oriented book, and this has been very influential, but without the active role in each country of local elites, of local governments, of local state, it would be impossible for the policies to be implemented. And having said that, they were very different and the meaning of them were very different in each place and the results were different as well. But everywhere is a disaster for different reasons, and different levels of disaster, I would say. So for instance, let me just give some examples of what I'm talking about. In UK, that under Margaret Thatcher, the right to buy and massive privatization of social housing was the leading policy. And now all the budget cuts to finance and to support and subsidize council housing and low-income housing by non-profit housing associations as well. And of course, in the case of UK, it had several consequences. One of the consequences was with all the discounts that the right to buy had and the fact that the stock was privatized to city tenants, so nobody was evicted by the time. I mean, that was a powerful way of Margaret Thatcher and conservatives to enter into the Labour Party constituency, working class base, like almost donating them an asset that was able also to be used as, like Nouria Roubini says, an ATM machine to finance consumption within a overall policy of fiscal austerity and of wage cuts for many, many years in the UK. So this was one case. But then if you take Croatia, the privatization of the housing stock in Croatia was mobilized in order to buy firearms to struggle against Serbia and to have money to do that. So it was completely different meaning. Or In some other cases, Eastern Europe post the fall of the Berlin Wall was massive privatization as well, but in different places the policy was not massive privatization, but it was financialization and marketization of low-income housing companies, like in Holland or in Germany, where it's not that the whole stock of housing was privatized, but the behavior of housing companies and public companies was pretty much financialized. So you have different meanings. And in the case of Global South countries as well, Chile as well, of Brazil and Mexico, we can give other, South Africa, the financialization of housing was done through a heavy participation of state subsidies in order for low-income people to be able to buy privately built complexes in the outskirts of the cities and towns. And that was a mean of cleaning up downtown areas or well-located areas from the existence of slums and campamentos and favelas. So it was a powerful mean and instrument of eviction and opening up these parts of the cities to the market and upscale market. That also was the case in other countries as well, where, like in the US, where public housing and public housing projects were demolished in order to open up space for more valuable in terms of the capacity of generating interest for the invested capital undertaking. So it's very different from place to place, but at the same time it's kind of the same direction. And it's important to say that this direction eventually was enforced by loan conditionalities with the International Money Fund. So a lot of housing sector reforms or housing finance reforms were implemented as a conditionality to get a loan in a moment where states were pretty much indebted.
So it's possible to talk about housing financialization as a global process, but the specific form that it takes is determined by the political and economic context that it occurs within.
Oh yes, of course. And also it's absolutely path dependent in terms of what was in place in the first time. So we can really, really see it as very particular. And also the leading actors are particular. Which is also, when we talk about financialization in Brazil and many other global southern countries, a lot of people say, oh, but I mean, the main actor here in the housing finance is still the state. It's not private capital and private investors. Yes, but the state has financialized its way of behaving. So we are talking again of very, very different forms that can take.
You became Special Rapporteur in 2008, which, as you mentioned, coincided with the global financial crisis, which had its roots in the extension of housing finance to new groups in the United States. Have you noticed a slowing down or a reversal of housing financialization as a result of that crisis?
Unfortunately, no. What we are seeing now, and when I wrote, when I was rapporteur, the home ownership and promoting home ownership was the leading policy. So housing financialization was done basically on promoting home ownership. But then, surprise, we have a new wave of housing financialization, which is related to rent and rental housing. So I wrote a postface for the English translation of my book, because it was written in Portuguese as the first edition, on rental housing. So basically what happened in some countries like the US after the foreclosure crisis, when you had a large amount of empty homes and apartments that were the result of foreclosure and the bankrupt of some mechanisms that were in place, the same investment actors came to be and to convert themselves into global corporate landlords. Global corporate landlords who were able to buy this stock, and this happened in many, many places. It happened in US, it happened in Spain, it's happened in Sweden, in Germany, where those global corporate landlords, they bought this stock and are pressing rents to go up, to extract more value from the housing stock and extract more value from, and this is leading to a very acute dispossession process, pushing people out of those of the apartments. This is one thing. And then, since the promise that homeownership will assure adequate housing for all was not fulfilled, there was a huge pressure in the private rental market everywhere. UK is a case where clearly the private rental market exploded. And you have several mechanisms of financialized housing related to rent. So even when you don't have global corporate landlords as such in some countries, you have mechanisms like Airbnb, which are pretty much financialized housing, which is destroying a lot of residential markets in tourist places like Barcelona, New York, London. And you have other mechanisms like this, which I think it's one of the most perverse mechanisms of housing financialization, which is the so-called golden visa, that big real estate investors can gain citizenship by buying real estate in the countries. I think it's very perverse, because that means that big players, big financial players, are competing with ordinary people to get the residential markets. And guess who gonna be winning the game? Without, and again, with the complicit and active role of states who are doing that and attracting that and destroying and dispossessing the citizens.
So we've also seen a mutation and a shifting in the specific form that housing financialization takes over time. It's changed form from the 1970s and until today.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I love this expression of Franco Berardi, an Italian philosopher, that neoliberalism is dead but dominant, and we are living in a corpse, and that's why it's so unpleasant, life those days. And I think that it's incredible how much those financialized policy could reinvent themselves. When it was very clear that they became a failure. But having said that, I think that more and more we are seeing all over the places citizens resisting, organizing, and trying to stop that. And I think this is very clear, and I was also following that when I was rapporteur, the rise of social movements around housing, including reinventing things that we have seen only in 19th century and early 20th century, like tenants' unions, rent strikes, and other types of actions around housing, which are taking place in many countries now, like citizens realizing that without their action and without their resistance, we're gonna reinvent ways of financialized housing and people will be out forever.
At this point, I want to situate the discussion of the financialization of housing within the city that we find ourselves in at the moment, Manchester. So, Isaac, you're one of the coordinators of Greater Manchester Housing Action. Could you tell us a bit about to what extent we're seeing housing financialization in Manchester at the moment?
So I think, you walk around Manchester and you see the cranes and at the same time homelessness. And I think financialization is the key thing underpinning this, the key thing to understand, to explain why the city is developing as it is. And I think it's really been pushed on the agenda in the last few years by social movements, as Rachel said. And I think, Greater Manchester Housing Action has been conducting research, basically looking into the flow of international capital into the property market in Manchester, or the Manchester-Salford kind of urban core. Absolutely right that Manchester, probably second after London in the UK, is very much plugged into this kind of global process of financialization. Mm-hmm. What we've seen, especially since the financial crash, is the kind of expansion of financialization, the emergence of kind of financial actors within property markets in Manchester. We've also seen, and this speaks to what was said earlier, a kind of shift from, build to sell towards build to rent, and often these are being built as blocks by kind of corporate landlords.
Could you just explain the distinction between those two things, build to sell and build to rent?
Yeah, so the dominant kind of development model prior to the financial crash was that new blocks would go up and each flat or housing unit would be sold off to people to own, mortgaged out to individuals, often to live in. What's kind of become more dominant as a model since the crash is that these entire blocks are owned by a kind of investment fund or financial actor and are then rented out. Or if they are sold off as units, often these are being sold off to people who are holding them as investment assets to then rent out. So they're not actually, even if they're sold off and mortgaged out, the people owning these are still renting them out to people locally. And this process is kind of internationalized, so you've got a lot of international capital flowing into property, and that includes sovereign wealth funds or, the rising middle class in China, or pension funds as well, Australian, Canadian pension funds. But I think the key point as well is that this isn't, talking about the path dependency and how local factors come into play. The City Council are actively kind of following this strategy and are actively partnering in cases with financial players. So a really key example is the Manchester Life Partnership, which is a partnership between the Abu Dhabi United Group, which is the sovereign wealth fund of Abu Dhabi, with Manchester City Council, who have then kind of sold off public land into this kind of partnership. The partnership is protected by commercial confidentiality. Various investment flows flow through Jersey. So there's a lot of, the role of the international tax jurisdictions, havens, is very clear in this. And this has caused, this is slightly to the north of the city centre in Ancoats. A lot of this development has been done through this vehicle. And actually only in August, just over a month ago, one of the Manchester Life Group issued a mass eviction notices to hundreds of their tenants after just a year, unless they accepted above inflation rent increases. And I think actually this was withdrawn after a big kind of political backlash, but I think this is a kind of indication of the kind of direction that housing is going in the city, mm-hmm. and exactly how, like, what's happening in Manchester ties exactly to the process mm-hmm. that Raquel has outlined globally.
So anyone listening to this podcast who is familiar with Manchester will know that there's a high-rise construction boom happening at the moment, and these properties that are being built, these are being built as financial assets rather than as homes for people. Is that correct?
That's correct. And our slogan as Greater Manchester Housing Action is homes, not assets, which I think is a really good, pithy way to think about this whole process and how housing has moved from being homes, being communities, to being financial assets. And I think, you know, as well as these big large-scale developments, we're also seeing Airbnb becoming a big problem in Manchester, especially in the city centre, but also now in neighbourhoods to the south of the city centre, places like Moss Side and Hume, which are historically black neighbourhoods. So there's a kind of racialised element to this. But yeah, at the moment there's a lot of heat in the real estate market in the city centre, but that is having impact across the city. And I think that's often, you know, local people who defend this kind of policy shift will say, oh, well, it's just in the city centre. They'll point to the fact that, you know, in the 80s, no one was living in the city centre. Historically, it was kind of ex-industrial space. But I think we really need to nail the point that it has a huge impact on the entire value of land in the entire city and also the region as well, I think.
And what are some of the impacts on residents of Manchester, of housing becoming increasingly financialised?
Well, increasing in affordability, I think, is a big fact. You know, the rents in the city centre are very, very high. But I think this is having a big impact wider than the city centre in terms of rising rents in kind of suburbs to the south of the city centre and to the north. And I think as well as rising rents, you're seeing estate demolitions starting to take place in the north of the city, around places like Colliehurst and Miles Platting, and also towards the Manchester City Stadium, the new Beswick estate, the Grey Mare Lane estate. There's planned redevelopments, and I think there's a lot of fear about these areas being demolished and not replaced like for like. And then also the kind of broader thing is that because the council are so keen to kind of make the real estate market so large and so kind of active, they're not using the powers that they could use to collect revenue or enforce social housing targets. So the council's own guidelines, I think, are like 10% or 20%, 10%, I think, social housing targets on any new development, and none of these have been met. They're also proving very, very bad at collecting Section 106 payments, which is the levy which local governments can charge on development, and they're not really collecting much of that money, especially compared to the neighbouring council of Salford, which actually has less development but is able to claim a lot more money from Section 106. And I think this is to do with the kind of political composition of the councils and which, you know, Manchester City Council has a much more right-wing leadership, basically, than Salford. And this is obviously having a big knock-on impact on social housing availability and social housing waiting lists, which is huge. You know, it's very difficult to get, almost impossible to get social housing, which is forcing people into the private rented sector. And then that compounds because private rented sector evictions are the largest cause of homelessness. So, you know, all these issues are completely tied together. And at the root, we would argue, it's because policy kind of pushes housing to be an asset rather than a home. So.
And to what extent have local housing campaigners been able to politicise and contest this model of development?
Well, I would argue it's been successful in this city. I mean, we both were involved in the establishment of Great Manchester Housing Action 4 years ago. And I think at that time, housing was less seen in this kind of political term, certainly not connected to wider economic structures, certainly not connected to issues of finance. And I think in the last 4 years, the movement has been able to politicise housing to a large extent. And this has been achieved not just through our work, but with the growth of tenants' unions. As you mentioned, we now have two tenants' unions in Manchester. One is Acorn and one is a group called Tenants' Union UK. There's also been kind of, you know, Greater Manchester Housing Action has worked to link together all the different diverse elements of the movement. So from squatters to, you know, academics to tenants' unions to different organisations, basically. And I think that kind of coordinated and strategic work has been very useful at politicising housing, but also make housing kind of the number one political issue in Manchester, which it currently probably is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, in addition to criticising financial capitalism, I think we as critical scholars, activists and practitioners have a responsibility to identify emancipatory alternatives that exist in the present and that could form the building blocks for a more just future. So I wanted to ask you both, just to finish, what progressive solutions and alternatives to financialized housing have you encountered? So I'll begin with you, Isaac.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the first thing to say on this is that a lot of this, you know, local government resources and powers are very limited in the UK to deal with this kind of stuff. But given that, there is hopeful, in our region, hopeful kind of political drives towards moving away from commodified housing. So particularly in Salford City Council, over the last few years, they've set up their own development corporation called Derive, which is building council housing again, exempt from right to buy because it's an arm's length kind of development company run by Salford City Council at social rent. And they've, I think by the end of this year, they're going to be breaking ground on around 300 council houses again, which is the first kind of construction of actual council housing in the city for three decades. And fundamentally, the key point is that they're exempt from right to buy. And then the other kind of seed of hope maybe at the moment is around community-led housing and community land trusts, which have actually surprisingly been given quite a lot of political support from the Conservative Party government. But it's being seized on in urban areas to potentially use, to be used as a way of holding back processes of gentrification, creating decommodification around housing. And again, this is being led by Salford City Council and the mayor there, and his role within the wider combined authority as housing lead. And he invited Greater Manchester Housing Action to be involved in the writing of the housing strategy, which explicitly mentioned how community-led housing basically can be used to hold back gentrification and disrupt these processes in the property market, personally. But that said, I think much wider change on a national level will be required, and a global level if we're actually to decommodify housing and turn housing back into homes, not assets.
I think that first of all, thank you for bringing this issue of what research can done also to the topic. And I see a generation of housing and urban researchers and activists at the same time coming in different places. So one of the things which is very, very, very important is to have research related to housing justice research methodologies. And among them, evictions observatories and means of making very visible something which is lived and seen in our cities as very personal, particular problems, which are not, are general. And I think that those observations and research can bring a broader picture. And also the initiatives to follow the money, to see what is behind those public-private partnerships, which are in principle non-transparent at all, and be dealt in an arena which is not the normal public arena where projects are being discussed. And I think this is very important. And second thing, since I think that the main goal, the global goal, the utopia, is to cut the umbilical cord between big investors, including pension funds, which are ourselves, and real estate and special residential real estate. And that can be done in several ways. Community land trust, cooperative housing, squat, all the ways of linking people with territories that are not open to finance to come and extract value. So I think that is open for the imagination of the activists of cities and around the world. But I completely agree that demands a lot of local action, experience, projects, and it's very important to do that, protect and promote that at the local level, at the council level, at the regional level, but also action at the national level and international level as well. It's very important because the power of this gray financial cloud that is just floating over the planet is so, so, so big that I think that we need an international force of residents and citizens to just block it.
Raquel and Isaac, thank you very much. Thank you. Urban Warfare is published by Verso and is available now. It's a must read for anyone interested in housing, urbanisation, international development and political economy.